Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap with Mike Donahue. Mike, how are you?
Good, Andy. Doing good. No complaints.
That's great. All right, so we are down now to the final 3 years of our... How many years was this? 31?
32, in fact.
32-year tour divorce of Cub history from 1980 to 2011.
Well, and we had special episodes throughout this, too. We did a 1977 special episode when the Cubs had a hot May last year, and Frank Nova joined us. That was a fun one. And we've done some other impromptu Remember This Craps that didn't necessarily correlate.
We did the Cub Hall of Fame.
We did.
Which is a classic episode.
It is.
And so we have an order. So people might want to set their DVR. Do you have to set a DVR to listen to a podcast? Probably not. So this one is going to be the 1987 Cubs. And then the next Remember This Crap. The next one's going to be a Bear Remember This Crap. But then we'll be back with the Cub Remember This Crap. It'll be everybody's favorite season, 2004.
Get your pitchforks ready.
And then our final one will be the 1984 Cubs. The 2003 Cubs, we did a three-hour podcast on that, right?
Right, and the listeners who may or may not have listened to it might not be aware that we had a technical glitch while recording that one.
Yeah, that's right. We had to actually share reenact part of it.
We did lost about 40 Nixon minutes.
Right? I would guess that the 84 Cubs, that will rival the Thornbirds as far as running time. There's a timely reference. Kids, there was a time when Richard Chamberlain.
I was going to say, special guest star, Richard Chamberlain.
he did the Thornbirds. Shogun? He did Shogun. I don't know what else. And a very underrated Richard Chamberlain movie, which I believe you could find on YouTube, is a movie called King Solomon's Mines. They actually made two of them, but you only have to watch the first one. It was a blatant Indiana Jones ripoff. But it had something that Indiana Jones didn't have, which was his sidekick in the entire movie and romantic interest, which Richard, as turns out, probably really didn't have any interest in. But
the Karen Allen analog, as it were,
Sharon Stone.
Oh,
it
a young
is prime Sharon Stone
would have been a
and
young
the movie
Sharon
is
Stone.
Legitimately and it's supposed to be funny. The movie is legitimately funny.
So Richard Chamberlain participated in a farce, is what you're saying?
That's right. They had all the sexual chemistry of, what was the movie, Summersby with Richard Gere and Jodie Foster?
Okay. Well, how would that rate?
2 hours of them looking at each other no.
Kind of to bring it back to sports, the baseball equivalent of Tony Perkins portraying Jimmy Pearsall in the movie adaptation of Fear Strikes Out.
Basically. All right, so we don't have to spin a wheel.
Yeah, we put the wheel. We decided to put the wheel down, not tempt fate.
So
makes sense. It works out that way.
I can tell you, I did no prep, so it's still Remember This Crap, but it's not research this crap.
Yeah, part of the reason I'm doing this is because I don't have to. Even knowing what's ahead, hey, I got a real job, and I'm happy. I'm happy enough just to be able to show up and do this. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure I'll ruminate on some things, but I'm not looking anything up until we start talking about it.
So five fun facts about the 1987 Cubs.
Ooh, all right, let's see. I fall in the habit of going starting with opening day because I think chronologically, and I'll do it again with a twist. Opening day play-by-play announcer Brent Musburger. That's right, kids. No Harry Carey in the booth because Harry, fact number two, had a stroke in the off season. And they wouldn't come back until some point in May. So fact number three would be the last season for 18 years in which Greg Maddux would be on a major league roster and not win 15 games. Greggy's first full season, rookie with the Cubs. Another fact in 87, sometime in early July, in a day game at Wrigley, I would say former Cub nemesis Eric Schau, except for the fact that the Cubs pretty much just consistently pinned his goddamn John Birch Society loving ears back both times they faced him in the 84 LCS, definitely made himself a villain when he beamed pending MVP, eventual MVP, Andre Dawson, in the face. And I kind of, I guess, gave it away there. I'll just say that in his MVP season in 1987, Andre Dawson did, in fact, hit a home run in his final Wrigley Field appearance. Those are pretty random, I would say. Doesn't quite paint a whole picture that season. But five fastballs, nonetheless.
This would be the final season for the architect of the 1984 Cubs.
Good point.
Dallas Green would resign at the end of the season.
Yeah, it really makes it very painful in retrospect to look at it now. But yeah.
And his his dynamic manager, Gene Stick Michael.
First full season.
I remember months into the season was still doing the, you know, I'm a lifelong American League guy. I don't really know these players yet.
That's ridiculous. Gene, of course, Gene, Michael, of course.
You had this job for part of last year. So
right, exactly right.
You had all off season. I don't know.
We can tell you the exact date because we referenced in '86 that, you know, the Sun Times made had some fun with the fact that Jim Frey was fired on Friday the 13th, as their headline told us. So from what, June 15th on, you're right. Like well into his reign by then. That was a weird hire. You know, we have not given Gene Michael any sort of treatment in all of this, but of course he was only around for half of '86. But as a kid, Gene Michael to me was one of these coterie of Yankee managers that were revolving in and out of the manager's seat that George Steinbrenner just kept spinning the wheel. The others being, of course, Billy Martin, most famously, like three or four times he was the Yankees manager. I think Bob Lemon had a couple different turns. Pretty sure Michael may have had as many as three. I'm confident he had two different turns. He was kind of the first Yankee manager that I remember at that time. But again, that was fluid. But he, in spite of being fired and rehired, he was, you know, he was in the front office when Dallas Green went over and selected. It just seemed weird. He was a Yankee player. Bill Lee, who I have spoken very highly of Bill Lee's autobiography. It doesn't hold up that well, but it's still pretty good. The Wrong Stuff. He talks about Gene Michael fucked up his shoulder in a fight, but he did it in a way that was really not very manly. I forget what it was. Gene Michael never really struck me as impressive. He was kind of a slight man. He was obviously a good enough to be a major league ball player, but he was a Yankee through and through, is my point. And so when we finally got tired of Jim Frey and his Coke bottle glasses, and the magic of 84 had pretty much evaporated. And we were in that lull between the two Dallas Green eras, the one the first of which he built a bunch of veterans around, and then second, a young team. That low point there, he somewhat mystifyingly just goes across country to New York and pulls Gene Michael out of that Yankee culture that he had spent his whole life with. And I think we discussed it before. Like, it seemed that that would have been the time to have given John Vukovich the job. And right. I only recently have really given that some thought, and it doesn't really square with me that he didn't. It's a really mistake by Green, I think, is not saying Vukovich would have been the guy, but the alternative certainly sunk a lot of ships.
Or they could have given it, just skipped Gene altogether and gone to the guy who took over for him when they fired him. Could have just given the job to the fabulous Frank Lucchese.
Right. I'm sorry.
Why, Frank had just been a manager 10 years before in Texas.
Well, so why is it that, like, and this is a Dallas Green thing, that his he fired three managers, but two of his, like, interim managers weren't even, like, coaches. They were, like, these old-timers that were sitting in the front office. Charlie Fox replaces Lee Elia. And then Frank Lucchese, who I learned later, you know, there's you know, worlds collide, but I always think of the fact that it just sounds horrifying that Lenny Randle, we talked about because he was the Cubs leadoff man in 1980, his 1 year at the Cubs. There's a video of Lenny Randle getting thrown a pitch under his chin. The very next pitch, he lays down a drag bunt, and he had it beat, but instead of going to first, he blows up the pitcher, going, which is pretty hilarious. But another thing Lenny Randle did was Frank Lucchese, is a much younger man in the late 70s, was talking shit about Lenny to the press, and Lenny in spring training, and Lenny beat the shit out of him.
And then, you know, kind of that was kind of a way of asking for a trade out of town. So, yeah, Frank Lucchesi, by 1987, when he comes in after Dallas Green gets rid of the G. Michael experience, whoever, you know, as kids, we're like, who's this guy? Who's this? Yeah. You know, he's not an old guy, but he was, you know, he was a lifer, just like Charlie Fox was.
He was 61 when they hired him. But the picture on Baseball Reference is when he's managing the Rangers, and he was 51, and he looks 80.
Well, he looked 80, 87 in 1987.
So, but hey, when you get a chance to hand the keys over to a guy who already had a career record of 308 and 382 with no division titles or playoff appearances, who had finished in his career, he'd guided teams to 5th, 6th, 6th, 3rd, 4th, oh, in second place in
second place.
Well, the Rangers got finished in second place in 1977, but Frank was the first of their four managers that year.
Really?
Yes. They were managed by Frank Lucchesi. He got them to 31-31. He got fired. Eddie Stanky was an interim.
What?
And Eddie went 1-0, and then Connie Ryan took over, and he went 2-4. And then Billy Hunter became their manager. And they went 60-33.
What?
They won 94 games.
I've never heard of this. The 77 Texas Rangers? Yep. I need to do a deep dive. Somebody must have written or produced something about
Billy Hunter. He only managed 2 years. He managed those last 93 games of the 77 season. And then he came back in 78. Yep. And they went 86-75. But then he got fired. And he got fired on the last day of the season, and Pat Corrales managed a game.
And then Zimmer was in there after Corrales, I think. Well, they were bad. I mean, I'm thinking baseball cards. That's nuts. I never had any inkling that the Texas Rangers, who were basically an expansion team in 1961, they were the second Washington Senators. First being the current Minnesota Twins. Their first postseason appearance, I know for a fact, wasn't until 1996. They were just woeful. You know, being a National League fan, I don't quite have that focus on the, you know, minutia of lower level American League teams, but holy shit, the Rangers, not just that they out of the blue finished second in 194 games, but they just kept rotating through managers. Some guy got white hot and the next year continued to win. He was over 500 the next season.
The 77 Rangers had two Hall of Famers in their rotation.
Ooh, let me guess. I pulled them up, but I haven't looked. Was Gaylord Perry on that team?
Yep, Gaylord Perry. He won 15 games. And this other guy won 14.
Another pitcher for the Wow, they had two in the rotation, right?
Yep.
Was Blylevin stop?
That was the other. And the rest of the rotation was Doyle Alexander. He led them with 17 wins. Doc Ellis was 10-6 with a 2.90 ERA. Dropping ass to the left and right. And Nelly Bryles was their other starter. He was 6-4.
And Bryles. Yeah, we've heard of all of those names. You and I have.
There's a lot of Chicago connections. Future Cub Jim Sundberg was their catcher. Future Cub Bump Wills was their second baseman.
Wow. Both have been given their due on this podcast.
Former White Sox, Claudel Washington, was in left.
Future.
No, he hadn't gone there yet. He hadn't fallen asleep.
Yeah, Jimmy and Harry hadn't gotten on his ass yet. Yeah.
Let's see. The father, is this right? Yeah, the father of a Cub outfielder,
Tom Grieve, right? Because he would go on to be their general manager.
How about this? Two fathers of future Cub outfielders on the same team. Their right fielder was Dave May, Derek May's dad.
Derek May,
and Tom Grieve was on their bench. And
this is like a reunion show of all the previous podcasts that we've done on this. Like, dude, come on down, Derek May. Wow.
Jim Fregosi, future White Sox manager, was their DH.
Yep, and 1993 World Series. Okay.
Let's see. Any other connections?
That's quite a team. I want to find some more material on the 77 Rangers. I'm not kidding. I want to learn about the manager carousel. A team that they would have lost to the Royals, I'm guessing. That was when the Royals were taking over that division and emerging. Jim Frey might have been in the organization by then. Bring it back. How about that? Nothing like a deep dive on the Texas Rangers of 1977, by the way, to kick it off. But
I apologize for
that. They even had the other Mike Marshall.
The other? Like, yes. Not the guy that pitched in 100 games right. in the and season, not or him, the and guy not that the, dated not the Carlisle.
Not the Dodger outfield. They had a guy named Mike Marshall from Adrian, Michigan, who played a long time in the big leagues.
This is amazing.
14 years in the big leagues. He was 70 and 67. No, he was 97 and 112.
Oh, man.
But it's not that Mike Marshall.
Or
that Mike Marshall. I didn't recognize the picture. Okay, there's only two. Because I gives it away. He back-to-back years, he pitched 92 games for the Expos and 106 for the Dodgers. So that's the crazy guy who thinks pitchers should throw every day.
He's dead now, I think. Didn't he die recently?
He died of overuse.
Well, no, he was an eccentric.
He died last year in Zephyr Hills, Florida. I almost said Zephylitis. Okay. He died of Zephylitis in Zephyr Hills.
Still the only pitcher.
That old Expo picture doesn't look anything like the Mike Marshall I remember.
But he's still the only pitcher to ever appear in 100 game in at least 100 games in a season, right? I'm pretty sure about that. Just to close the door on the 77 Rangers.
Until Rowan Wick does it this year for the Cubs.
Thank you. To close the door on the 77 Rangers, Mike Hargrove, Human Randley, and Bert Campaneras, best known for playing every position in the game or in his career, one of those. But, boy, that is a colorful team. Juan Benitez also in there. Remember from my baseball cards, Kurt Bavacqua, who is a briefly World Series hero in a series in which the Cubs should have played, but we'll talk about that in October. That's enough about the Rangers.
So the 87 Cubs, I remember we were shocked when we did the 86 Cubs that it was not the swan song for a bunch of 84 Cubs,
right,
that we thought it was. So the 87 Cubs still have Jody Davis, Leon Durham, Ryan Sandberg, Keith Moreland, Steve Trout is still around.
No appearances by Sayre Matthews, right? So I was surprised that they were still, right? They were on the 86 team, but not on the 87 team at all. Right?
I don't see him.
Just fact checking, that's all. Steve Trout was an 87 Cub, and I've brought it up several times, and I have to bring it up now just to put it in its place. His last two appearances, you'll see, I'm sure, I'm going to pull it up, but I know that they were both shutouts because Steve Trout was traded after the second of those two shutouts, and he was traded for, and I only remember this now because we rehashed it, but I think Dean Wilkins, Rich Schein, and Bob Tewksbury, none of whom did anything for the Cubs, one of whom would actually reemerge with the Cardinals and do pretty good. But, yeah, Trout still had some value. I mean, his best season was 84, but they dealt him as soon as he threw those back-to-back shutouts. So,
well, sell high. Attaboy, Dallas.
Yeah, well, I'd like to see the Cubs do that with Ian Happ now.
He made 11 starts for the Cubs. He was 6-3 with a 3 ERA, 3.00. Three complete games, two shutouts. And he pitched 14 games for the Yankees and was 0-4 with a 6.60 ERA.
Oof.
He then got traded to the Mariners with Henry Cotto.
Former teammate.
Yep. And who'd they get? Oh, I managed to click away from the page. So that makes it hard to... let's see. The Yankees, who gave up the haul of Rich Hyde, Bob Tewksbury, and Dean Wilkins, turned it into Lee Guterman, Clay Parker, and Wade Taylor.
Don't know any of them. Yankees were in their 80s malaise. Vaguely. You know what? I do too. Honest to God, I got a Lee Guterman baseball card randomly by a Cubs usher like 2 years ago. Like, they have like some weird inventory of worthless baseball cards that aren't even Cubs, and when they see you with your kid, they'll give you some.
Right.
I'm pretty sure I got a Lee Guterman card. So there, game is due. Dickie Knowles was still on the 87 Cubs. I'm impressed. I just pulled him up myself. Happened to notice that.
Wasn't this the big year where he got traded for himself?
Dickie Knowles also, like Phil Nevin and Greg Maddux, got traded for himself. Or wait,
That's something else. He got traded for himself.
He got traded for himself. All right.
Didn't
yes.
trade himself.
And September 21st, 1987, Dickie Knowles was traded to the Tigers for a player to be named later. On October 23rd, 1987, the Tigers named the player, and it was Dickie Knowles.
Incredible.
Sent him right back.
It's not the only time that's happened, has it? Is it? Probably not.
I don't know. But
I don't know that I ever knew that.
It's
I must have at some point.
The Cubs were so enamored of getting Dickie back that 17 days later, they cut him.
Wow.
Poor guy.
Yeah, I wouldn't have
enough
guessed
to drive
that.
Him to drink. Oh, too late.
No, it was actually, that was a little bit earlier. I don't think that trade helped, though. You're right. No,
it doesn't do a lot for his self-esteem.
Well, I'm sorry. Dickie actually was gone after 84 to Texas and then to Cleveland.
Yeah, he'd come back.
And then, so, okay. Yeah, I have no recollection of the Dickie Knowles return.
It's sad. The only two things I know about Dickie is that he was an alcoholic and that he got traded for himself.
The third one is that he found himself in the middle of controversy in the Dallas Green Jim Fry World Series of 1980 when he threw high and tight to George Brett.
Ah.
So that might be out there somewhere. And also, of course, let's close the book on Dickie Knowles by just pointing out that he was one of just a veritable bevy of Philly players and prospects that Dallas Green just sort of swept into the Cubs organization, which you can't fault him with considering the results in 84. So not that Dickie had much to do with the 84 team success.
Bobby Dernier was still a Cub.
Yeah, but not getting 125 starts a year like Rick Monday would in the 70s.
No, he wouldn't. He played in 93 games. He hit .317 with a .379 on base and a .497 slug. Bobby Dernier posted an .876 OPS. He had 8 homers, 21 RBIs, stole 16 bases. So what do you do? Ripping his hamstrings off his leg? Why did he only play 92 games?
Can I remember some crap?
Sure, that's what we're here for.
Pretty sure that Bobby Dernier in 87, I'm going to find it, hit a walk-off. We didn't call it a walk-off, kids, in 1987, but hit a walk-off home run off of, and I'm pretty sure it was Cincinnati, not New York, reliever. Here it is. I'm going to find it Thursday, May 21st. John Franco.
Wow.
Apropos of nothing, but I found a game, and God damn it, I'm going to make sure that that we're aware of this otherwise mundane, pointless game. But sure enough, a game in which Lee Smith blew the lead in the top of the ninth by giving up 2 runs. So I guess he just they had a 2-run lead and he blew it. But, yep, Bob Dernier, home run off of John Franco.
I feel like I should.
Cubs win.
Well, yeah.
Go ahead.
Walk off.
Cubs win. They're 24-15 at that point, by the way. Cubs went off the good start.
That was Stick Michael had him rolling. Great job.
He did.
Great job by Dallas to hire him. So I feel like I've relatively well acquainted with the 87 Cubs because so many of them were a huge part of, I don't know if you saw it this week. Did you see, remember this crap print edition in the newsletter? Since you haven't been talking about it, I have a feeling you didn't see it. At the end of Monday's newsletter, the Cubs had a longtime employee die.
Oh.
I got to look it up because I want to get her name right.
Yep.
That was in this.
I think I did miss this, but I did see a reference to.
Yes, her name was Arlene Gill. She worked there. She worked for the Cubs for 40 years, and they posted a picture to go with it of her and a very shit-eating granny Jim Fry and traveling secretary Pete Durso, not assistant to the traveling secretary, the actual traveling secretary. But the part of the picture that I was most intrigued by is that on a chalkboard behind them, they had the Cubs 40-man roster written on the chalkboard with names erased and names added to it, and I set out to pinpoint the date that 40-man roster would have been accurate. And I figured out it was the off season because of a trade that had happened and a trade that hadn't happened yet, so it had to fall between two dates.
Okay.
So let's see. What trade hadn't happened yet? I found a story about Jody Davis that I didn't know. He got traded to the Braves.
We talked about this.
We did on September 29th.
Yeah, the penultimate day of the season or something.
But I didn't know he said this. I actually found the quote. Alan Solomon in the Tribune. You know who Alan Solomon's wife is?
Yes, Carrie Muscat.
Carrie Muscat. He quoted Jody. I think they took a step backward when they got Jim Fry. I get along with Don Zimmer all right. He's up front with me. I just don't think Jim Fry knows what he's doing.
Wow.
Jody wasn't wrong.
Wait, but that's in 88, by the way. Yeah, it's Jim Fry's
first
year.
That was the next year. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a lot of 87 Cubs that are still on that chalkboard.
I'm looking at it now. All right, I pulled it up. Frank DePino, Goose Gossage. Why are they smiling with those names? Drew Hall, Mike Harkey, Les Lancaster, Greg Maddux.
Al Ripper. You see those two names that are erased? This is great. We're talking about this. People are trying to picture it. That's great. So there's the pitchers are the far left-hand column, and there's Mike Bielecki, and then there's a name that's erased, and then there's Frank DePino. And then on the far right is
underneath the outfielders. Jerry Jackson.
And between Darren Jackson and the great Jerry Mumphrey, there's and I figured out who the two names are.
Oh, Palmeiro and Jamie Moyer, right? No, I don't know.
No, they're in alphabetical order. So it's Mike Capel and Dave Martinez. And I'm like, well, that's ridiculous because Dave Martinez got traded months before then. But if you look, all they did was they wrote because Mitch Webster's name was the last in the order.
Yeah.
The poor intern is like, I am not rewriting this whole fucking list. So he just wrote Webster at the bottom and left the gap. But the key was that it wasn't even that Rangers trade because that didn't happen. Oh, I think it was the Rangers trade. It had to happen.
Well, that was like in the off season between 88 and 89. Yeah.
So it had to happen.
That's great.
It had to happen in a 50-day period between October 15th and December 5th. And the key to it was Bob Tewksbury. Bob Tewksbury and Bill Landrum, they were both released on October 15th. And they are not on the board. And then the trade on the 5th was the... that was the Rangers trade.
Okay.
And I even pointed out, we talked about Fry, how he fucked up. He traded Lee Smith because he thought he was lazy and washed up.
And then he compounded the mistake.
So how about this? So on the 15th, they released those two pitchers. They released Tewksbury, who went on to win 60 games for the Cardinals in 5 years. And they released Bill Landrum. And you're like, big deal. They released Bill Landrum. The 2 years that Mitch was the Cubs closer, Bill Landrum was the closer for the Pirates. The first year, he saved 26 games. He had an ERA of 1.67. And the second year, he had an ERA of 2.13. So if all Fry had done was just leave Bill Landrum on his team, he could have kept Rafael Palmeiro.
But he was definitely chasing.
There were other extenuating circumstances that may have
led to absolutely.
Rafael and Dave Martinez both being traded.
Yep.
But here they are. This 1987. And we get Palmeiro's debut, and it's Davey Martinez's first full season.
Technically, his debut was his.
Or did they both start in 86?
Okay, no, Martinez came up in 87. I was impressed when he first came up, too. I didn't know where he came from.
Yeah, they both had a cup of coffee in 86. But Palmeiro was only up for half the season in 87. Dave played the whole season.
He did. And when I looked it up, I think on last week's or whatever, rabbit hole we went down, I was amazed at what a statistical fine season statistically that Martinez had, because I don't remember thinking he was really that good at the time, but the numbers would suggest he was. It was our center fielder, maybe.
This was the Cubs had an embarrassment of riches in center field that year. Three guys. We just read Dernier's stats in half a season. He had a great year. Martinez, Dave had a 370 on base, 372 in 142 games. And then Jerry frickin' Mumphrey probably should have been the National League MVP. He slashed 333 with a 400 on base and a 534 slugging.
Christ.
In 118 games. He got screwed. Who was the MVP that year? Oh,
That's right. What I'm trying to figure out.
It was Andre.
Hello. Well, that's
otherwise Mumphrey. That's probably, so the Cubs, did they finish 1-2? Right. I'm sure they did.
Right. It was like the MVP equivalent of Jerome Walton and Dwight Smith. I guess that's probably a good segue.
What an outfield they had! Holy shit! It might have been the greatest outfield in Cub history that year. Let's look at the MVP voting.
Could have been.
Andre won easily. 269 votes. Ozzie Smith, only 193. He finished second. Ozzie Smith, second. Jack Clark, second. Third. Then Tim Wallach. Then Rafael Palmeiro's former college teammate, Will Clark.
Part of the reason that an MVP from a last place team won is because that is a really weak-ass year. It had to have been. I mean, if Ozzie's your runner-up and Tim Wallach, and who is between Wallach and Ozzie? I already forgot.
Jack Clark.
Really? Top five? I mean, Jack Clark was a good hitter for a few years. That's just a weird – 87 was the year of the rabbit ball, too. Like, home runs were inflated from 86, and it went back down in 88. There was a lot of shit. There were, like, quotes in Sports Illustrated about a rabbit ball.
I don't see Mark McGuire, I don't see Jerry Mumphrey on this list. Oh, that doesn't seem fair.
For MVP? Yeah. You're still trying to give Jerry Mumphrey his due?
That somebody – listen to this. How many first place votes? It doesn't show how many first place votes. Tony Gwynn, he finished eighth. And all he did was he hit 370. Pfft, big deal.
Do that today, you might be winning.
370. How about this for Gwynn? 370, 447, 511. No, he never hit any homers. Seven homers.
So did Jack Clark?
218 hits.
Jack Clark must have hit 40 homers because it was the year 35. Of the home run. So that's it?
He led the league in on base and slugging.
Okay.
Actually, Jack Clark
had a fine season.
He hit 286 with a 459 on base and a 597 slugging. His OPS, Andre's was 896, and Jack Clark's was 1.055. On a first place team, as opposed to Andre. 49 homers, 137 RBIs.
Now, in fairness, and I will get to it and give it its due, but it was an unusual season in which there were no, except for the Pirates, I think, shitty teams in the NL East. The Cubs competed. I mean, I just talked about Daniers' walk-off against Franco. They're 29-15. They're playing well. And I want to say there were three 90-win teams in that division that year, and I want to say that come Labor Day, the Cubs were either 500 or were like within like eight games of first place or something. It never felt like they were in a pennant race. Don't worry. I don't think there were too many teams in front of them, but it's just an odd season all around.
Cubs were in first place on May 19th. And they finished 19 and a half out.
I think a lot about April and May too, just with the arrival of Dawson. There was so much anticipation. I mean, it's a weird thing. We were already been sort of, had a taste of awesomeness in 84 with the team, but there was that lull, and then we get Dawson on the cheap, and he got off to a slow start, but then he started doing shit like, I want to see it, five hits in the game in April or May against the Giants. I think he hit for the cycle, which it only took 6 years before Mark Grace was at the next one, and we still haven't had one since then. But I always think early on, the excitement that Dawson started producing after the first few weeks, he never really stopped. And the team was better than I remember, but they were competitive.
Yeah, they won 75 games. I mean, the team right now is going to finish third, and they're not going to sniff 75 wins.
Yeah.
So it was kind of bad luck.
He also, Dawson also in April or May, once he started heating up, I'm pretty sure all these things happened. Yeah, I think he had a five-hit game. He hit for the cycle all around the same period. Could have been the same goddamn game. But he also threw out a batter at first base.
Yeah,
it was a pitcher, Kelly Downs of the Giants. I think in that series, I have a feeling if you just hone in on that otherwise meaningless early season series, that Dawson just started to tear it up. But he did get off to a kind of a slowish start, and then
he not really. He hit 296 with a 360 on base and a 605 slugging in April.
Okay.
Six homers. So I've been, well, maybe I'm really early. I guess, yeah.
Well, opening day, his very first plate appearance. His very first plate appearance, the bases were loaded, nobody was out, and Brett Musburger was in the booth because I stayed home from school because at that point, I'm going to watch opening day. There was no – there was no Irv Cross and his oddly parted cropped afro. Yeah. There was a lot of anticipation. It was exciting because Brent, you know, spent time in Chicago. He was at the peak of his – I mean, he's been on the scene for 50 years, but he was really like the guy. And he gets the opening day assignment because, as I said, here he had a stroke in the offseason. And in the Kelly Dwyer's favorite player, Jim Lindemann, was making his debut in right field, Maine West's finest for the Cardinals. But in the bottom of the first inning of opening day, somehow – the bases got loaded for Dawson's first plate appearance, and he like hit like a tap, you know. And it was, but yeah, so that left an impression. But you're right. Well, I guess within short order, if you're going to win the MVP, you can't really have a totally shitty April. But there's the Giants series that I kind of remember. There were like a game or two in there where it was just like, hey, Andre Dawson hit a home run. Hey, Andre Dawson hit five hits. Hey, Dawson hit for the cycle. Hey, Dawson threw a guy out at first base, and it was like, man, we were excited about this guy, but shit, we didn't know he was this. Like, we did, but we didn't expect it, I should say. We didn't expect this. Like, we hoped for it. He was awesome from day one, I guess. I mean, not because I was splitting hairs. He didn't have a great opening day, but he was pretty
after 12 awesome. Games on April 21st, he was hitting 167, 231, 313.
That's it. 2 weeks. That's only 12 games yet. So, and then boom. Bring on the Giants. I just reassociate a weekday series against them where it's like he heated up and he never cooled off.
And his first at bat as a Cub against John Tudor. The Cubs,
our nemesis.
Bob Dernier had singled. Ryan Sandberg had doubled. Dernier went to third. Dawson actually drove in a run.
He did, but not the way you'd hope.
He ground ball to Tommy Herr. That Tommy kicked. Yeah. And
that's what it was. It should have been double play, I think.
So he didn't get an RBI.
But you know, like, it was kind of incredible that his first at bat was that, right? Like, comes up, bases loaded. So how are you going to – the guy met the moment so many times for this team that season, he just didn't do it the first time. He totally met the moment.
The Cubs lit up John Tudor.
Well, that's – good. I don't remember that.
I mean, they got eight hits in five innings.
So scarred by him. And they lost the game, though, right?
Yes. He only lasted five innings. He had eight hits and three runs. Bill Dawley pitched the last four. He got a save. Rick Sutcliffe shit the bed. He was 2 2/3. He gave up five earned runs and seven walks. He had a Ryan Dempster, no strikeouts.
But Sutcliffe would himself, like Andre Dawson, rally and almost join Dawson on the podium. When he lost one of the closest Cy Young votes ever, and in retrospect has been considered one of the most egregiously misawarded Cy Youngs to Steve Bedrosian. So, yeah.
So Andre Dawson, month by month, he hit six homers, 20 RBIs in April, eight homers, 21 RBIs in May, six homers, 23 RBIs in June, eight homers, 23 RBIs in July, 15 homers, 28 RBIs in August, and 6-22 in September.
Yeah, I was at one of those August games where he tied a game in the ninth. I think off of Bedrosian too, believe it or not. And I think they won it. He had a few game tying homers after the seventh inning. I don't know if he had what we would have called walk offs then. Pretty sure it was just I can't even really describe what it was like. He just kept delivering. I mean, I know that's not. I can't even do it justice, or you know, I'm verklempt.
Here's some trivia for you. Who was Andre Dawson's first agent? He's from Florida, and this guy would be best known as a member of the Dolphins' undefeated Super Bowl team.
His first agent.
His first agent.
Well, clearly not Mercury Morris.
No, probably not. Probably not Garo Yepremian either.
Was it Nick Bonacotti between cuts of
That's exactly who it was. It was Nick
Jesus Bonacotti. Christ.
By the way, moment of silence for the recently deceased Len Dawson.
Yep.
Nick Bonacotti's partner inside the NFL. Holy shit. Well, good for Nate. He was a Notre Dame guy, right? I mean, so probably smart guy. He had a law degree, or he's just being an agent out there. Huh?
I mean, I would think he was still
crazy
playing, right?
Nick Bonacotti was playing football when Andre Dawson was a rookie in 77. Could have been. I mean,
we got to look this up now. Yeah. He played because he played forever, I thought, although maybe he was old.
By the way, on the and just to correct my memory, in the first game of this much ballyhooed early season cold midweek April series against the Giants, Andre Dawson actually went 0-for-4. So must have been the second, third game in which he busted out. Yeah, so, 5-for-5 in the second game.
It's, all right, go ahead. It's yeah, he was playing. Yeah, but his last Nick played. He played for the Patriots from 62 to 68, played from the Dolphins from 69 to 74, but came back and played in 76. And that would have been.
So he had a career that spanned from 62 to 76?
Yeah, I knew he played forever.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Nick Bonacani.
Wow.
Who knew? Oh, these baseball reference pages are full of all kinds of little nuggets.
Yeah, I like that. So, yeah, just to recap.
Who would you rather have as your agent, Nick Bonacani or Roquan Smith's mom?
Or Roquan Smith.
Roquan Smith.
Yeah, it was mostly the second game of the series where Dawson went 5-for-5. Was clearly the game in which he also hit for the cycle. He did go 2-for-4 in the finale, and in one of those three games had an assist. So we can move on. Move on to the game.
I was going to say, this was famously the Andre, the blank check season.
It was, yeah. Maybe people don't know, because there are some younger kids that do listen, I know, just for your edification. This was the season of collusion.
Collusion.
I guess you could say, right? Yes. Like, yep. Tim Raines, like, wasn't able to play his first game for the Expos that year till May, and that's because he had to go slinking back. There were a whole bunch of players that didn't sign, but they were locked out because of the, you know, however it was structured. There were no big free agent signings going into the 87 season. Andre Dawson was a free agent. The Cubs had, I don't know, like, other than Dallas Green's early tenure, I mean, they never really signed huge free agents. Like, Dawson was at the peak of his career in spite of all of his knee injuries. Like a Dan Hampton. And the market just, the price came down. Like, the Cubs were not going to commit to it. Tribune Company wouldn't let Green do it. I think Green was already a little bit on the hot seat, as would be evidenced. But then the price came down. And then famously, Dawson wanted to be a Cub is the other part of it. You know, he was playing on that parking lot in Olympic Stadium that was painted green. And, you know, he liked the idea of playing in the sun. Cubs still didn't have lights in 87, playing on the grass. So he kind of gave up his hand a little bit, and, you know, a little bit, I guess, because ultimately it ends up in, as you said, blank check. He's basically stalking the Cubs in spring training. He doesn't have a team yet. A lot of players don't have teams yet. I mentioned Tim Raines. I can't think of some others, but I'm sure we can find it. And he and his agent were, you know, just stalking Dallas Green outside of Ho-Ho Cam, and eventually the proposal was a blank check that was given to the Cubs, and they just had to fill it in.
So he had been offered a two-year, $2 million, $1 million-a-year contract by the Expos to stay. He turned it down, thinking, well, I'm going to do better than that. And you're right, he's in spring training, and he doesn't have any offers. He's not doing better than that. And the contract the Cubs gave him only guaranteed him $500,000.
For 1 year.
And he would make $650,000 by just staying off the disabled list before the All-Star break. He could go on the All-Star in the second half. But it had
incentives to stay healthy.
And he cashed in after the season. He signed a three-year, $6 million contract with the Cubs.
But look what he had to do to earn that. Yeah. It seems,
he said when the,
you know,
MV, he had 49 over 537 runs for his dog shit last place.
Just be incredible. Really an incredible season.
So if you look at his career, now famously like you said, the turf in Montreal had worn his knees down to a fine dust. And in 86, he was okay. He played in 130 games. He had 20 homers, 78 RBIs, 284, 333, 478. But he was well down from his peak. He was an all-star from 81 to 83 with the Expos.
Do you know if the Expos moved him to right? They did at some point. He was a, because he was a center fielder for the Expos in those years that you just referenced, 81. I'm pretty sure he was. Because Valentine had the cannon in right, and I think Cromartie was their left fielder.
He moved to right field in 84.
Okay. That's it.
He would still play center in the All-Star game when he was a Cub.
Yeah, for the Cubs, that's right. We hashed that at Wrigley Field, I believe, too, in fact. Maybe not. I mean, he was an All-Star at least three times with the Cubs, four probably. Probably got voted in every – probably.
But he had won Rookie of the Year in 77. Mm-hmm. He won Gold Gloves in 80, 81.
Center field. 82, playing center field.
83, 84, and 85.
Wow. Like Kenny Lofton.
He won two more.
I'm sorry.
Ken
Griffey.
He'd won two more for the Cubs. He won Silver Sluggers in 80, 81, 80, and 83. And then he won one of those for the Cubs, obviously, his MVP year.
So
he had, finished second in the MVP voting twice.
Before 87?
81, he finished behind Mike Schmidt.
Yep. And then Dale Murphy in one of those other years.
Yeah, 83 would have been Dale, right?
Yeah. Or 82 and 83 for Dale. Yeah, they had back-to-back.
Yeah, but Andre was 83.
That's Dale.
No, I mean, he finished second. He finished second in 81 and 83. Not 82.
Right. To Schmidt and Murphy, respectively. Right, but Schmidt won back-to-back, and then Murphy won back-to-back, and then Sandberg won it, so. All right, so he won a Gold Glove and a Silver Slugger playing center field in 81, 82. I think that pretty much makes you automatically one of the six best players in the game. If you're winning the Gold Glove in center field, which is pretty much outside of the battery, the second, sometimes first most important defensive position. I mean, shortstop, it depends on, you know, a few factors, but so he's winning Gold Gloves in center field and he's winning Silver Sluggers in center field. That doesn't probably happen.
Well, and when he retired, he was one of only three players in history that had more than 500 doubles, 400 right. homers, and 300 stolen bases. And it was Willie Mays.
Willie Mays was one, yep. It was a Bobby Bonds.
And Brian Dayett, I think.
It was Kevin Roberson.
Yeah. So, elite company. Got him in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, you know.
Hank Aaron. I believe it was Hank Aaron.
Well, just like one of those experiences where, like, when the first time I saw Pulp Fiction after everyone talked it up, and it was like, there's no way it's going to be as good as you guys are talking about. It was like the anticipation for Dawson. It's amazing to think that it actually exceeded the expectation because we were pumped.
Yeah.
Felt bad for him, maybe. Signs that lowball contract because the owners colluded. But it was like, shit. I mean, because he was. You just outlined it. He was obviously one of the best goddamn players in baseball. Anybody with a pulse could recognize that. And he's our right fielder. Now, you know, no offense to Keith. You know, he's one of my guys, Keith Moreland. We'll talk about 84. Got to push. And, you know, Zoc tried his hardest, moved over to third base. And holy shit, we got Andre Dawson. And then he delivered, frankly, way above and beyond what we would have even, you know, realistically hoped. It's just, like I said, I get verklempt when I think about it. It really was kind of an amazing thing to witness in real time.
Yeah, he'd been all-star three times in Montreal in 12 years. In 6 years with the Cubs, he was an all-star five times.
I can't believe it was only three times. Probably because he was too hurt around the all-star game.
Nobody even knew that they had a team.
Bullshit. And
then he comes
That's
down.
That's true.
Then and he I'm comes gonna, down gonna, and he's playing on WGN every day.
I will challenge that, and I have to bring my brother-in-law, whom you've met at the golf outing, on. He will challenge that because the Expos actually drew quite well.
I know they were very popular in Montreal.
You're saying for the All Star national recognition
In real North America, the middle part. They had they spoke French and they smoked cigarettes all the time. And nobody knew what the fuck was going on up there.
They don't have deodorant, but
they got the outfield distances are in meters. You know, you don't understand any of it.
They got.
How many meters did he hit that one, Harry? I don't know. Jesus Christ. I didn't know there was going
to
be mass.
So sports writers gave him his due. Fans wouldn't vote him in to start, but then he should have still made some of those teams three of them, bench player.
I think his knees basically felt, we talked about this, the 89 podcast, his knees had fallen off by the end of the season. So he was shell of himself in that postseason.
Correct.
But he had, he bounced back. In 90, he did.
We discovered that.
He had 27 RBIs, 91, 31 homers, 140 RBIs. His last year with the Cubs, when they couldn't get 91. Rid of him fast enough, he hit 22 homers and drove in 90 runs. He was on his last legs, but he was still hitting.
His rate stats were, you know, dwindling, but he still had power. And he stayed healthy enough, too, which is impressive. So, overall, very is he a Cub Hall of Famer? I don't know how it's probably not even worth discussing because the Ricketts don't even know how to roll that out. But
I don't think he is.
That's a Cub Hall of Fame career.
I think he was supposed. I think
it's only five seasons though. But
we talked about. I can't remember. Right, Mark Gonzalez and I talked about this, right? About how everybody thought this was the year they were going to catch up, and this was like the year that the '80s Cubs went in, and guys like Andre would have gone in.
They give Pat Hughes and Jose Cardinal
and Buck O'Neill, which is fine to put those three in, but there should be like seven other guys that go in with them.
I don't understand why they're spreading it out.
Weird shut-in Ed Hartig is over there with his list. I don't know. I think these are the guys.
Right. But Dawson at some point will get it. He's already a Hall of Famer.
Is Marla Collins in?
I don't know. Is Yost in? Yost is in, actually. Marla might have been too short of a tenure.
Or shorts. She certainly was. Harry made sure she was famous. We knew who Marla Collins was.
We'll have to do a roll-up of crap we forgot, because I think when she was fired, I was at the first game she wasn't at. I'll just tell it now. It's my buddy Dave. We're only 11 years old, but I don't know if our parents, I don't know who else was with us. We were sitting there, and we noticed Marla was not there, and then he made a stupid 11-year-old kid joke about, wouldn't it be funny if she ran across the outfield naked? And then literally the guy in front of us said, she got fired this morning because she was in Playboy. Like, what?
What year was that? That was 82?
I'm pretty sure it was 83. Because 82, she was ushered in. She comes in with the whole, everything with Dallas Green is new, right? Tribune new. Everything is like new broadcaster and Harry, new farm system. We got Bump Will. We got all, everything's new. Marla County, that was all 82. So she did less than two full seasons.
What year did the Honey Bears get whacked?
Super Bowl. Superdome was their last game, yeah.
85.
Oh.
I just wondered if maybe Vag was like going around and, you know, well, taking care of business, calling in old accounts.
Well, she might have been shaking her head when the Cubs were forced to fire Marla, because she's like, see, this is what can happen.
Well, yeah, because she walked in and George was, you know, the magazine all the way open. Georgie, what are you looking
at? Mom, doesn't anybody knock?
Funny because it's true. George is a renowned chronic masturbator. I mean, we just got to tell him.
No, according to the record, just a longtime subscriber of Playboy.
That's right.
For the article.
He used to write. Well, he wrote it. He wrote letters. He also wrote them to Penthouse, too. I didn't think it would happen to me. I was in the equipment room.
Well, I'm just glad I got
a woman's car broke down.
Yes.
And she came in and needed assistance.
Cubby blue pinstripes. And she had a bucket of balls. So I at least
I was the one who rubbed the balls.
I was at the game when Marla Collins was first not there. But yeah, within short order, within less than 2 years, Harry made her a local celebrity.
He did.
She was, you know, a very attractive young lass who had to be, you know, she was very athletic. She got, you know, kept the field clear, and Harry made sure it didn't go unnoticed. But long gone by 1987.
I was hoping that there would be a list of, help if I could spell, of celebrities who filled in for Harry Carey in 1987.
I would love that. By the way, the Brett Musburger game is not on YouTube. What is the second game of the season, which was our household favorite growing up, Mike Royko. However, much as my family loved Mike Royko, and I will, you know, I'm a huge Royko fan. I tweet anything that's related to him. I devoured him as a kid. I own all his books. He was absolute poet laureate of Chicago for the last half of the 20th century. However, whether it was election night when he was on Channel 2 or doing this Cubs game, I remember my peers always criticized him. He was always not good on TV, and he did not do a good job. I think I referenced that because George Will, actually, who many saw as sort of a counterbalance to, you know, Royko, he was national, but he was conservative, did his homework and did an excellent broadcast with Steve Stone in Philadelphia later that season. So, as I said, George Will was one. I'll go off the top of my head. I can tell you guys, I know who did it. Royko did game two, but Bill Musburger started it. Bill Murray was the legendary one. John Belushi did a game in San Diego. I mean, Gary Bender, future Bears broadcaster, did a game. Oh boy, I'm running out of them already. George, there were a lot because
George Wendt did a game.
George Wendt did a game with not John Ratzenberger, but holy shit, the guy from not necessarily the news who looked like John Ratzenberger. Who the hell is that guy with the mustache? Danny something. Danny Breen. But those were both in Philadelphia. There was the George Will game and the George Wendt game were both in Philadelphia. Yeah, because Cheers was at its peak, so George Wendt, locally famous and nationally famous. Had to be a lot. It was a lot of them because Harry didn't come back until like the second or third week of May. So there were, you know, and I don't think there were too many games of the week. There might have been a few, but you're talking basically at least at minimum 30 games. So I'm out of them now. I thought I'd be able to rattle off more.
I really thought somebody'd have a list. Doesn't Casey Ignarski doesn't have a list on his?
That sounds like something Casey would do. He's got some pretty good old videos, and he keeps tracks of uniform numbers. But
Fred Mitchell broke the story on March 22nd. I think. WGN may rotate celebrities while Harry.
And deals. I believe that also may be a project would have Cubs marketing guru, burgeoning guru John McDonough's hands over that too. I think he might have been involved. It's similar to the seventh inning stretch conductor they do at the ballpark. It was same spirit of that idea.
So he had Fred had a list of celebrities the Cubs had contacted.
Okay, run them off. I'll tell you if they did a game.
Pat Summerall.
I don't think so.
Ernie Harwell.
Don't think so, because he had his Tigers. He has Tigers broadcast.
Dick Enberg.
I think so. I think Enberg may have done it. Jack. Although Enberg had a day job.
Well, yeah, but he was national then. I'm sure he could get a day off to go.
Okay. Right.
Jack Buck.
I may have. Jack may have like skipped the Cardinals.
Bob Gibson. Why the why?
Don't think so.
Stan Musial.
Nope.
Bill Murray.
Yes, of course. George famously. Wendt.
George yes. Will, yes. David Letterman.
No, I'd be all. I'd remember that.
Mary Frances Vec.
Nope.
That's all they got.
Okay, they didn't mention Jim Belushi. It was a game in San Diego for Belushi.
Oh, it was Jim Belushi.
God,
yeah. Not John well, dead. John was dead.
Oh yeah, John had been dead for 6 years.
Yeah, so that's new. So he probably didn't do one then. That would have been a story.
That would have been. Yeah, it would have. It would have really gotten a lot of attention. God, I'm frustrated that I can't. I guess I stopped ruminating about it through the years because I remember one point in my own head kind of keeping track. Because I remember that Philadelphia series. George Will did one game and then George Wendt did another, both in Philadelphia.
Now, the Bill Murray one is good. And it's one of the, you know, even though Marquis supposedly has the vault and they can play any game they ever want from the GN years or whatever, they play like eight of them. And one of them is the Bill Murray game. The umpires, they're playing the Expos, right?
There are like the a couple excise.
The umpires' uniforms didn't show there's up. There's a lot.
There's
stuff.
You know what? There's a lot of shit going on. That is one of them. The Eric Gregg, of course, always seems to show up here. He was one of the umpires, and he gets mocked rightfully, inappropriately by Bill Murray. I think there are like a couple excised, or the one major one on YouTube you can find is not the full game, but there's enough. There's absolutely enough that it's worth. But you're right. The umpires were messed up, and a few other things. The one thing I will tell you is that, believe it or not, it was a Friday game, and I did not get this. Well, even if I wasn't in school, I did not, and I wasn't, but I did not get to see the Bill. Or see, it was Good Friday actually, because Easter Sunday was 2 days later. But I had my point is I happened to be at that game. I was in the bleachers. My sister took me, and she was an undergrad at Loyola. And all I remember about being at the game that Bill Murray broadcast was that she happened to stumble across in the bleachers a lot of her sorority sisters, and one of them was a little tipsy early on when the announcer said that leading off for the Expos was Casey Candel. She said, "Why can't you tell?" True story.
Casey Cantel.
And then I regretted it. I'm like, I love going to Cubs games. I went to as many as I could that, you know, I'm like, that's the one game I wish I had stayed home and watched. Because when I got home, I remember it was even on CNN headline news. Bill Murray does a Cubs game. And there's a highlight of, like, Tim Wallach going to the dugout to get a pop-up. And Murray's like, fall in. Because Tim Wallach, I don't think we've ever mentioned it in this podcast. Might as well mention it now because we're done with the 80s. Notorious Cub killer. And Bill Murray knew that. So.
One of the he yells at one of the Expos, "Hey, do you still beat your wife?"
Yeah. Not, in his mom,
not a joke you could.
And then his mom come up to the booth, and of course he's just mocking her from. She was sober, but he's like, you know, pretending she's lit up. Mom, what is that on your breath? You know, I mean,
the underrated one though is he did a long stint in the first night game.
You went into some detail.
And it helps that Harry's there. Harry loves. Harry's, you know.
And that's the thing. Harry wasn't there. Harry asked him how his mother is. Harry asked him how his mother is. To be a straight man. Right.
And he plugs. Is that the one where he plugs Scrooged? Maybe that's a different step. It's a different.
Scrooge came out in 89.
But Harry's like, it sounds like it's going to be hilarious. Well,
Scrooge came out in 89. He probably did. So I bet you he did.
That could have been. Yeah. Yeah, see what he's working on.
No, that's but you're really right. Funny.
He was
in the booth a lot with Harry.
Yeah. And they loved to be there together, and it was always fun.
Right. But oddly enough, the Harry Carey game was Stoney having to sort of perfect being the straight man, which, of course, was really in his wheelhouse because he was still really a little bit more of a closed-off nerd than he would be, you know, before he got bold. You know what Cubs game I wasn't at? Or here's another way to phrase it. You know how I know, Andy, that Mel Brooks' Spaceballs came out in 1987.
Oh, because you skipped a Cub game to go see Spaceballs?
Well, I didn't just skip a Cub. I just happened to go to Spaceballs because it was early July, and the Cubs were playing the Padres, and my friend, who was a White Sox fan, his dad took us to Woodfield. We see Spaceballs, laugh our asses off. Thought it was one of the funniest things ever. His dad picks us up, and he tells us that Andre Dawson got beamed in the face and basically tried to attack Eric Shaw, the pitcher. It was kind of terrifying to hear him, and then, you know, that was all the news that day. Yeah. So that's something that weird season overall. We've already established that. But in the midst of Andre Dawson's just incredibly thrillingly entertaining season, he incurred a very iconic and violent act by just, and again, worlds collide. You know, worlds tend to sort of just run into each other, and it happened to be, like I said in the top five facts, I think that the guy that hit him was Eric Shaw, who was an 84 Padre, which we'll get more into that next week. But it was pretty nuts. A few things happened in that game I think probably worth maybe spending a minute on, because wasn't Greg Maddux pitching for the Cubs also?
Okay, so before we get to that, I neglected to do something I'm supposed to do.
Did you hit record?
I actually, we are recording, amazingly. But how about this? The wait is almost over. A new football season is about to begin. Get ready for the NFL Week 1 action with DraftKings at Casino Queen Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. To celebrate the return of football, DraftKings is giving new customers a can't-miss offer. Bet just $5 on any football game and get $200 in free bets instantly. Want more action for opening night? Everyone can experience the thrill of DraftKings early win promotion. Get up 7 and you win. Bet on any NFL team of your choice, and if your team leads by 7 points at any point during the game, you get paid instantly, even if your team loses. How would that possibly happen to the Bears? Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use promo code POINTLESS to get $200 in free bets instantly when you place a $5 bet on any football game. That's code POINTLESS. Only at DraftKings, at Casino Queen Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem, crisis counseling and referral services can be accessed by calling 1-800-GAMBLER, 1-800-426-2537, 21 or older, Illinois only. Bonus issued as free bets. One early win token issued at opt-in. Moneyline bets only. Deposit wagering restrictions apply. Eligibility and terms at DraftKings.com/football terms.
Did I ask, does that incentive only apply to new downloaders? Because I have begun dabbling in the DraftKings
world. If you have not set up a DraftKings account, when you set it up, you will be eligible.
I'm not eligible.
But anybody can do the thing where if you, on week one, you pick a team, as soon as that team gets up by 7 points, even if they end up losing the game, you win. How about that?
Okay. For a score, basically?
Well, it could be. It could be any time. Okay. The field, slinging the ball all over the place.
The last bet I made, I have to say, I thought when I took my 89-year-old father out to the Cubs game about 10 days ago, first time he'd been to Wrigley Field in 3 years, which had been the longest he'd gone without being in Wrigley Field since the early 40s, including a 2-year stint in the Army. So it was nice to get him out there, and I figured, well, Justin Steele's pitching. I know the Cubs might be going for the sweep, but I don't care. I'm out here. I'm just going to burn a $50 bet on Justin Steele and the Cubs. And I was sitting pretty until David Ross went to the bullpen. After 6 innings, no runs by Justin Steele. So, nevertheless, I'm sad to admit that I cannot capitalize on that incentive for DraftKings. But
are eligible for one of the two.
Okay, the other one, I already have it. That's my point.
Yeah, you don't get. You're not going to get. You're not going to turn $5 into $200.
Okay.
Well. But what if you bet, say $1,000 on the Bears? And then they score first, you win. Even if they lose 41-7, as long as they were up 7 points at any point in the game.
I'm sold.
How could you not? How could you not do it? All right. So while I was reading that long thing, did you by chance look up the Eric Schau?
No, I was ranting, but I can find it pretty quick because I've got Andre Dawson's game log up. I can pin it. I said early July, but oftentimes I can be wildly off. But it was, in fact, actually, it was pretty 1987. Where are the Padres? And yeah, here it is. So I'm going to suspect that it was July 7th because that was because that's a game where he started and apparently left in the third inning. So
a face full of baseball.
Yeah, it was nuts. And I don't know, because it does show you, right, on Baseball Reference, like what they're batting at the time, right? They're not like, so, I mean, after the game, he had a 907 OPS. Of course, still trailing your beloved Brian Dayette, who after this game had a 1.031 OPS.
And also, that the Cubs didn't turn him into the Hall of Famer he was always meant to be.
No. Well, he's the one who came in for Andre. So,
well, it was an upgrade.
But, And Dawson hit his 24th homer off of Schau in the first with two outs. 24th homer in early July. So April, we do 8 homers a month. I mean, he's on pace. He's on pace basically over a 48 homer season, which is what he would end up at. So we're continuing. He's continuing to just enthral us. You know, ever since once he got hot after 2 weeks, it's just not cooling off. So, yeah, first time up, goes yard against Eric Schau. Keeps the inning alive. They score a second run after the Padres had scored one off of rookie Greg Maddux in the first. By the way, Dave Martinez hit a solo homer to lead off the game. So, Andre puts them up. So, the Cubs have come into the game with a 43. They're down to 43-39. So, they'd kind of fallen a bit since that Dernier walk-off put them 24-15. But, you know, they're fighting. And Dawson's leader. And notice who's not in that lineup, by the way. I should just point this out right now. Look at the double play combination. And this, it's probably something we might want to dwell on before we close. Considering this was a team that really wasn't that bad. Had we had the much promised in their prime double play combo of Ryan Sandberg and Sean Dunstan, right, who knows what would have become of the 87 Cubs. But
you think they were better than Paul Noce and Mike Brumley?
I will say that both Paul Noce, especially Paul Noce, but both he and Brumley got off the hot starts the first couple weeks. So it was kind of like a joke. Hey, these guys are pretty good. But then we had to live through a long summer. Because Sandberg, I don't know what happened to Sandberg that year. He was out a long time. And Dunstan, you know, it might have been Dunstan's first big injury. But they were. I just remember that as being the summer of Brumley to Noce. We didn't have Sean and Rhino. Kind of sad. Especially in retrospect, because it really wasn't that shitty of a team.
I wonder.
I mean, Paul Noce, OPS, by the way, 783 after this Padres.
Did Rhino have some kind of injury that would have forced him to, I don't know, leave his wife unattended for long periods of time?
Is he rehabbing in another part of the country?
Well, or Cindy all alone.
And he's like, hey, I'm in Chicago. The kids are here. I've got the seats in the wives section. I'm going to keep going to the games. And maybe hang out in the clubhouse, you know, after, just to say hi, you know, come down with some of the girls.
87 was the year of my infamous Tim Tuffle batting practice home run catch.
Oh, all right, put it in its proper place.
On 14? On Billy Williams Day.
Oh, you were there for Billy Williams Day. Yes. Very nice. Yeah, Billy Williams, worth noting, finally, because it was sort of getting to be a sort of an annual angst-ridden thing. Ernie gets in 82. Well, no, he got in 77, but then, you know, Cubs were too busy just being Wrigley's to do anything about it until Dallas Green comes in 82. We finally retire Ernie's number. We have an Ernie Banks Day, and then it's like the conversation was, when is Billy Williams going to get in? When is Billy Williams going to get in? So for a few years, January of 84, January of 85, January of 86, Billy Williams did not get enough votes to get in the Hall of Fame. Finally happened in 87. I actually remember where I was. My dad was so overjoyed. Channel 9 News told us at the top of the 9 o'clock hour. 9 o'clock news. So yeah, 87. Billy got his due because he's finally a Hall of Famer.
So that was not the first Billy Williams Day. They had a previous Billy Williams Day in which there's a famous picture of the. I'm sure it was new, but it looks like they gave him a used car.
Oh yeah, right when he was a player still, yes. Right?
When he broke Stan Musial's record for consecutive games played, June 29th, 1969. Between games of a doubleheader, they gave him.
Which is thoughtful.
So it's like, hey, look, this is cool. There's a whole video of the Billy Williams Day ceremony from '69 on. But Al is the one who posted it, so I don't know if I'm going to share that or not. I don't want to give him the satisfaction.
Yeah, you're a man of principle.
Maybe I will, just because.
And maybe at this point, what's the harm? He's off on his own thing. He's got them safely ensconced there anyway, where we want them.
In this, the Eric Schau game, I noticed that the third baseman for the Padres was Chris Brown.
Hmm.
Do you remember the most famous thing that Chris Brown ever did? This is not the Chris Brown that.
Did he go on the disabled list?
This was a different
Chris for like Brown. A. Right. All right. He was a third baseman. Yep. Went on the disabled list for something weird.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Sprained eyelid.
Yeah, I thought it was eyelids, but I'm like, what?
Claims he slept on his eyelid wrong and it wasn't working right. He didn't go on the disabled list, but he missed a game. He took himself out of the lineup due to a sprained eyelid. So when he's playing for the Giants.
Yes, I remember Chris Brown as a Padre and Giant. I feel like he was traded for another third baseman, but.
I thought he got traded for. The wrong Chris Brown comes. I don't want that Chris Brown.
Is there another baseball Chris Brown, or are you just Googling the, Chris Brown's and found the wife beater?
The singer who...
Yeah.
That was Bobby Brown that hit people. That's right. I'm disparaging poor Chris Brown.
Christ.
Chris Brown came out as being gay. That's fine. But Bobby Brown, punching everybody. Is there another... I don't want to get into this. I think there's... I don't know. Something bad.
Maybe with a K. Who knows? Let's move on.
I thought he got traded for Kevin Mitchell.
That's what I was going to say. then I guarantee you you're right. But then it sounded stupid because Kevin Mitchell was a third baseman, but he was a left fielder when he won the MVP.
Trade was this year coming on. Oh, he got traded to the Padres.
So he came up a Giant.
He had just come over on July 5th. So
Kevin Mitchell went from the Mets to the Padres and the Giants. Got it.
Keith Comstock, Mark Davis, current Padres announcer and local boy, right? Mark Grant. I forget where he went.
That's Mark Grant. Mark Davis is Juliet Catholic. Keeps coming up, by the way. Yep. Yep. And both come up. Both of those guys come up. It's a pretty noteworthy trade as far as names that we can still remember.
Traded for Dave Dravecki, Craig Lefferts, and Kevin Mitchell.
Yeah. Well, you brought this trade up again because Craig Lefferts has the funniest journey of trades. Yes. So, wow.
And then a year later, he would get traded again with Keith Moreland.
To the Tigers.
Yeah, for Walt Terrell.
Walt Terrell, 84 Met. I also see in the Padre lineup that year, the eventual, to stand alongside what should have been Rick Sutcliffe, but was instead Steve Bedrosian and Andre Dawson, the rookie of the year, future Cub, and then he sucked with the Cubs, Benito Santiago. So there's a rookie of the year in the Eric Schau game. I didn't even look, too. I'm sure there's video of that. I'm sure you want to post it if there is.
Oh, I'm sure there is. I'm
sure there's tons of it. Now, remember, Eric Schau, it's spelled Eric Show, kids. Now it's Schau, S-H-O-W.
So the Cubs pitching staff had two Hall of Famers on it.
Greg Maddux and Lee Smith.
And Lee Smith. Greg Maddux had a great year. 6-14 with a 5.61 ERA. Struck out 101 in 155 innings. Walked 74. Who would have ever thought that little Greggy was ever bad? But he's only 21 years old.
He was young.
He was young. Also in that rotation, a guy who would go on to win, well, I got to look, how many games? 269 games in the big leagues.
Jamie Moyer. Who, if you were an idiot kid like me who didn't know, nobody really knew too much besides Bill James about sabermetrics, you would think that Jimmy Moyer was the better pitcher than Greg Maddux because he won more games.
Well, yeah, so they had quite a year. He was 12-15 with a 5.10 ERA.
Losing record. Yes, he won 12 games, but he lost 15 and got pounded. He's like, it's just a flesh wound.
Ed Lynch was an 87 Cub. He had a great year. He was 2-9 with a 5.38 ERA. Did almost as much damage as he would do later as a general manager.
Right. Oddly enough, I just happened to associate Ed Lynch with the 86 Cubs. I didn't know he hung around. I just found something apocryphal about Greg Maddux, by the way, and it ties back to the Andre Dawson gets beaten in the face because the story was that Greg Maddux started that game. He was Eric Schau's counterpart. And that the story was that in that game, Maddux, who was struggling, he's coming into the game. Oh,
yeah. Rick Sutcliffe tells this story all the time. So you're going to tell me that it's wrong.
It's apocryphal. I'm looking right now. This is July 7th. And I'm looking at Greg Maddux's game log. The story is, and always has been, you know, in most circles, that in that game in which Andre Dawson, which I don't even know if he broke it down, but just look at the video. Crazy scene. And he went on the DL. And then the game resumes. And Greg Maddux retaliates by plunking, which I'm sure did happen. You could find it in that game. But he supposedly plunked the Padre in retaliation, got ejected because, of course, after the Dawson hysteria, you know, the umpires have to sort of get a hold on. It was a mad scene. You know, and everyone, if you haven't ever seen the video, you'll see it. Had to restore order, so warnings were issued. Greg Maddux was supposedly struggling, although he's only 5-7. He'd do worse later that season. He was not really struggling that bad. The rumor was that he's on the fulcrum and he could be sent down if he continues to like not do well. And he was in line to get the win in this game. And before the fifth inning was complete, where he would qualify for a victory if the Cubs were even winning, and I'm checking to see if they even were at that point in the game, and they were.
Yes, it was 5-2.
And then he plunked a Padre before he was eligible for the win because Dawson got hit in what inning?
Dawson got hit in the bottom of the third.
And then in the top of the fourth, You know, Dea comes in. So, yeah, Benito, eventual rookie of the year. Maddox strikes two guys out, and then he hits Santiago.
And he gets tossed.
He's out of the game. So that's that part's true.
That's true.
What's not true is that Maddox's, you know, prospects were hanging in the balance. He did get sent down later that summer because his record would get worse. But he pitched again 3 days later because he only threw three innings. And then he pitched 8 days later, 6 days later. He was not sent down. I couldn't even tell you when he was.
I don't know if he was. It's like a lot of Rick Sutcliffe stories. Most of it's true, but it's embellished. He embellished the stakes, basically. Greg did what he said he did, which was Greg in his first year when he's trying to win games.
All of that is true, right. There's a lot at stake.
But
for
Rick
him to
makes
not
it
do
sound
that.
Like the Cubs are up 8-0 and it's an easy win and Greg gives it up. Yes. And that that he was worried.
And that everyone's staring at him like, if you don't turn it around, son, you're going on this Vandergill.
I don't know if it was Rick or somebody else. Somebody else in their telling of the story says that the thing they enjoyed the most about it was they didn't have to tell him to do it.
I like that.
Like
I hope
went
that
out
part's
and he
true.
And he even waited and he picked out the catcher. You know, Shao's out of the game, but you know, if they were throwing it Andre on purpose, he waits for Benito to come up, and he hits him.
Yeah.
Of course, Benito might have been their best player, too, in 87. Was that his rookie of the year?
The Padres were
They have Tony Gwynn. He's never going to be their best player. Given the way Greg pitched to Tony Gwynn, he probably should have hit Tony.
Right, it's the one guy. It's the one guy. So I would say that Maddox was sent down briefly because there's a span between August 3rd and August 16th. He didn't pitch. So he was. It's what you got to do, especially if you're a team that's not seriously competing. You got a young pitcher. Just fucking throw him out there. And that's what they did. You know, he took a pound. He was 6-14. His ERA was up there. But he, you know, obviously was a pivotal experience for him.
So who got the win? Scott Sanderson got the win.
He vultured one.
His fourth of the season. He would go on to win 8. Attaboy.
Yeah. Scott didn't get a double-digit victory season for the Cubs until his final season in 89. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think 89 might have been the year when he hyperventilated on the mound at Dodger Stadium and had to come out of the game. Remember that?
It could have been. Sanderson, no offense.
He's just like started to. It's like, was the line from Friends? He's not breathing. All he's doing is breathing.
Right.
He's hyperventilating.
Right. One last thing about Maddox in 87, I want to just remember some crap, is that early in the season, in whatever situation, sometimes he was a few times utilized as a pinch runner. Which I thought was kind of a novelty at the time. It wasn't common. I mean, I'm not giving Gene Michael credit for it. It was just, you know, anything innovative. It was just sort of stretching his bench. But it was kind of cool. Maddox was a good athlete, obviously. He won all those gold gloves. He was a good hitter. I mean, everything about the guy was just, you know, the approach
probably
was there.
The only pitcher who was wearing his spikes in the dugout. There was a game during the Dusty era when Kerry Wood pinch ran and scored. And he scores, and the inning ends like right away after that. And the GM or whoever was doing the game got a great shot of him. He grabbed his glove and he ran. He acted like he looked at Dusty and acted like he was going to run to continue to play in whatever position. He had pinch run for it. Like he was heading to left field.
Oh, Dusty nice.
Dusty had to stop him. It was really funny. It was clearly done as a joke. But he's like looking at him. He's got his glove and he's running out of the dugout. And Dusty's like waving it back. Like, no, you're not in. I didn't put you in the game. Thought that was funny. Joe probably would have let him play. Sure, go for it.
Yeah.
He had Strope and Travis Wood out there and left for a while. Of course, he ended up...
That's true.
They kind of ruined the 2018 season, right? Was that when Strope got hurt? He got to hit in that makeup, the Hurricane game.
Oh, the Washington. Yeah, that slog down
the
stretch.
He let him bat, and Pedro ripped, like, almost got, like, he hit the ball hard. It was right at the third base line.
The Senators, I don't know if it was Ryan Zimmerman or what, but And he tried to leg it out, and that was kind of the end. That's a
they've been their most reliable reliever, and he was gone for a while.
I just wanted to do one more pointless game because I was at this game. Had my cousin from London that was there, and if you thought I was sunburnt, you should have seen her. But we were in the bleachers on August, and I only bring this up now, not just because I was there, but it was August 2nd, 1987, because it's the intersection of Andre Dawson winning the MVP, Rick Sutcliffe getting robbed of the Cy Young, and Steve Bedrosian, who did win the fucking Cy Young, had a chance to nail down a save in a season in which he won the ill-gotten Cy Young, and our guy, Andre Dawson, in a game I was at, fucking tied it with a home run in the bottom of the ninth inning. So this is basically a big fuck you to the sports writers who voted Steve Bedrosian over Rick Sutcliffe, because in that very season, he couldn't even close out a game against a last-place team. So just want to enter that for the record.
This caught my eye. So the game after the Shao game, Greg pitched at home against the Dodgers.
Greg's next start after the one that was suspended.
Yeah, against Oral Hershiser.
Oh, just like game one of the 1995 World Series. How about that?
And Greg went, he got suspended after eight innings. Greg had pitched all eight innings, gave up three earned runs, four runs total, 10 hits, struck out five. Oral pitched 7 2/3, and he had given up 10 hits and three earned runs. But this caught my eye. So Greg balked in the game. This is July. How many balks do you think Greg Maddux had on July 10th, 1987?
So I'm guessing he balked a lot?
It was his sixth.
Wow. Okay.
He's probably doing it on purpose. It was all because he's
setting him up.
He's just smart. Greg's smart. He does that shit.
Yeah. Greg's always about the long con. I want to know why that game was suspended. It must have been raining going on because it only went 10 innings. It had to be suspended late.
Yeah, it was suspended. The Cubs tied it in the ninth.
Yeah.
And then it was suspended. It was suspended in the ninth.
Weather unknown, but yeah.
How did they tie it?
It had to be weather, obviously.
Ken Howell was coming in to get the save. And
Ken Howell. Sure. Ken Howell? Okay.
Jim Sundberg singled. Manny Trio walked. Walked. Holy shit. Gary Matthews pinch hit for Frank DePino. And he struck out. And Dave Martinez doubled. It scored Sundberg. And Manny got thrown out at home with the what would have been the winning run. Paul Nochi struck out and went to extra innings. Mariano Duncan tripled in Steve Sachs. And the game ended when Keith Moreland hit into the game was prolonged with two outs in the 10th when Rafael Palmeiro singled. And actually advancing Andre Dawson to second. So runners to first, second, two outs, and Keith Moreland hit a double play to end the game.
Oh, there you go.
Trade that son of a bitch to San Diego.
So that was the start. That was the start after Greg Maddux's Andre Dawson game, but the game after Andre Dawson got beaten. I put the link in there, July 8th. I'm only going to bring this up because our guy Oleg would tell me the story for years. He once went to a Cubs game in which he left early. And Cubs are getting crushed. And I don't know what the score was. I just know that he tells the story that he stepped off the subway like the Skokie Swift. He's like, you know, left the game like an hour ago. And supposedly Jim Sundberg, and this is the reason I looked it up because you just mentioned Sundberg. And we've mentioned before, too, it was kind of interesting. Sundberg was an everyday player every year up until this season, and the Cubs just decided to bring him on board, even though they had two-time All-Star Jody Davis. Sundberg, great defensive catcher. You know, that's all you need. But in this game, Jim Sundberg sparked a huge comeback by hitting a grand slam that I believe tied the game. And Oleg only learned about it when he stepped off the aisle, and someone's like, Jim Sundberg tied the game. I'm an asshole because I left early. So I'm just giving Oleg a shout out because he would talk about that game for a long time. Games in which we left early and something fun happened.
Cubs were down 8-4 in the bottom of the eighth. Moreland singled. Jody Davis walked against future Cy Young Award winner Mark Davis.
Right, an opening day starter against
Lance McCullers came in.
Oh,
and Manny Trio walked again. Holy crap, Manny was a walk machine that year. Jim Sundberg hit a grand slam to deep left field, it says.
Maybe Waveland.
Then Dave Martinez singled. Paul Nochi sacrificed him to second. Leon Durham was intentionally walked. Then Bob Dernier singled, scored Dave Martinez. Rafael Palmeiro came in. He popped out. Now there's two outs, and in comes Goose Gossage.
Who would be a Cub less than 7 months later.
Yep. And Goose had his good stuff. Keith Moreland doubled to left, scored Leon Durham, Dernier to third. Jody Davis. Goose throws a pass ball, scores Moreland.
Well, that's not Goose's fault. It's a pass ball. That's up true. Here's Rookie of the Year, Benito.
That's right. Then Jody, how about this? I wish we had video of this. Jody tripled. A Jody Davis triple, scoring Keith Moreland. Ooh, this is the majesty of Jody Davis and Keith Moreland scampering around the bases.
It looks like a football, sort of a suicide drill. Oh, that's great.
Cubs scored 8 runs on 6 hits, and they were up 12-8. And Frank Dipino came in and got the last 3 outs, and the Cubs won. Way to go,
Oleg. There you go, Oleg. We remember some crap from a game you were at. It happened in 1987.
I thought you were going to say he gets. I really thought the story was he gets to the L station and Jim Sundberg, while the game is going on, is there. It's like, has got pinch hit for whatever, and he's just fucking right. Went home. And Oleg, I'm on the train.
Yeah, they got a bullpen catcher. They don't need me.
He's like, I'm done. They can't put me back in anyway. I'm just going home. Yeah, Sundberg was a vastly overqualified backup catcher.
He was. It was strange.
We said how many gold gloves he won last year. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, you pointed that out. And he was an everyday player for the Royals just up until, So, interesting embarrassment of riches, really, especially by 1980 standards. The Cubs had a catcher.
Yeah, he won 6 gold gloves in a row between 76 and 81.
Yeah. So, and Jody was a very good defensive. I mean, Jody was, he played a lot. He was good all-around catcher. Better catcher than Sundberg, probably, because he had some offense, but and some legs and some wheels, because, there he is going home to third on a ball hit to the right field in Wrigley.
Yeah. So, we broke down, I think, that he got traded to the Cubs for Thad Bosley and Dave Gumpert. But did we break down the trade that got him to Kansas City in the first place?
Texas?
Listen to this. This was a 4-team trade.
Are there any? Was Jim, by the way, Jim Sundberg, was he not a 77 Texas Ranger, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Got it. A much ballyhooed.
January 18th, 1985. 4-team trade involved the Brewers, the Royals. Who else?
So before the 85 season?
The Rangers sent a player named later and Danny Darwin to the Brewers. The Mets were involved. The Mets sent Tim Leary, not Timothy Leary, but Tim Leary, to the Brewers.
From that, yep.
The Royals sent Don Slott to the Rangers. And the Royals sent Frank Wills to the Mets.
Rangers, you know a lot of those people.
Rangers sent Bill Hantz to complete the trade. It seems like completely unnecessary that had to be one 4-team trade. Just make your little trades.
Well, and Sundberg was one of those guys that I only knew through baseball cards because, again, no cable, and I'm a National League fan. But I guess I didn't realize he was a World Series champ. He was the everyday catcher for the 85 Royals that met the Cardinals. So good on him. And then the other fact that I have to point out whenever I see it, Jim Sundberg's career WAR 40.5, which puts him above the Harold Baines bar. So, by the Harold Baines metric, Jim Sundberg is actually a Hall of Famer.
Sundberg got traded. He got traded a few times. He got traded by the Rangers to the Brewers for Ned Yost and Dan Scarpetta. And Dan Scarpetta is from Rockford, Illinois. Pitched at Rockford Auburn High School. And
holy fuck.
He was one of the original Beloit Brewers.
I thought you were going to say one of the original members of Cheap Trick.
Yes, also that too. Yeah, 1982, the first year of the Beloit Brewers, and Rockford.
How do you know that?
Pitcher Dan Scarpelli. I was there. That was the year Dad and I went to a bunch of games.
Do you remember Dan Scarpelli, or you just saw that he was on the 82 Beloit?
I remember Dan Scarpelli.
I don't remember him. Was he a major leaguer of any note?
He never made it to the big leagues.
And so he's in the Rockford Hall of Fame.
He got, how close did he get? He got to, he pitched in AAA two seasons.
So he was obvious local legend because, like, you just recited a whole bunch of facts. He was like your Dave Otto.
So he was 19 years old in 82 when he's pitching for the Brewers and didn't pitch very well. Came back to the Brewers in 83, and he went 6-6 with a 3.89 ERA in 18 starts. Got promoted to the Carolina League, Salem. But then he was back in Beloit again. Oh, how about this? In 19, I believe he threw a no-hitter for the Beloit Brewers in 1985. He was 13-3 with a 2.27 ERA. He's still 22.
Oh, man. Heartbreaking. He didn't get his cup of coffee. That's when he had to get it. I wonder what happened.
Well, he's in the Midwest League.
He's still A-ball. I'm sorry, he's still at A-ball. My bad.
This is a whole different world. The prospect perverts would pass out. 13-3 in 20 starts. He threw 8 complete games. He pitched 2 games out of the bullpen, finished both of them. He threw 4 shutouts.
He got promoted. He pitched a double and triple A maybe right after that, right? Tell me he did. I know he never made the bigs, but he had to have gone to at least double A.
85 and 86, he went to double A.
That's it, though.
87, he played double A and triple A.
Oh, man.
But I'm positive he threw a no-hitter for the Beloit Brewers.
Might have happened. Go check with your old sports information friends. Are all those records extant? Is Beloit still affiliated, unlike Kane County?
Yeah, they're affiliated. They're in the Midwest League. They're the Marlins.
Oh, I'm sorry. King County used to be in the Midwest League. Yeah. King County used to be the Marlins affiliate. Now they're Nomads.
I don't see any confirmation here that he threw a no-hitter. He threw a few in high school, but that shit doesn't count. That's sure. Everybody does that.
No. Yeah, Sean Dunston.
I threw a no-hitter in Little League and not having a fucking parade for me.
Sean Dunston batted like 820 in high school. Okay.
Let's see. I'm killing time here trying to find the... Yeah, it would have been... In this article, it would have been up front.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it now, though. Unless you have any more Dan Scarpelli nuggets to add. But no.
Chris Bosio pitched for the Beloit Brewers. He threw a no-hitter in the big leagues for the Mariners.
You sure that wasn't Juan Nieves? Did Bosio also throw a no-hitter?
For the Mariners, not the Brewers.
The Mariners, right. Okay. So, the Cubs in 1987, like on this date, what is it, September 1st? They were 3 games over. They were 12 games out. They were in 5th place in the 6th place division. But that does sort of confirm what I was trying to grapple at earlier, that it was an odd season, you know, a lot of really good teams. Probably the peak NL East, you know, Expos, Cardinals.
Well, we went through that, yeah, the 80s. The 80s.
Well, they were, but I think it all came to a head in 87 because I believe you had 391 teams. The Cubs still were over 500 as late as September 6th. They're at 500 September 7th, and that was it. But still, 3 weeks to go, and they're still dabbling with it. It's just interesting. I mean, they never were, like I said, nobody, you know, especially 3 years after 84, when maybe the slightest glimpse would get you to drink the Kool-Aid. I mean, nobody ever felt they were really in contention down the stretch, but they were not ever really that shitty.
Well, they did
not. They were 500 teams until then Gene Michael got canned and nobody cared anymore.
They were 10-8 that year against the Expos. They were 9-9 against the Mets. They were 8-10 against the Phillies, but they did not do well against the Pirates or the Cardinals. They were 4-14 against the Pirates and 6-12 against St. Louis.
Okay.
That's what cost them.
And it also probably didn't slow down the Cardinals, who couldn't have won the division by too many games because the Mets were defending world champions. And they would win the division the next year, too. So they were certainly in the midst. And the Expos were just always just the Mex. Any year in the '80s, the Expos are always like ranging from pretty good to just really good.
Yeah, the Cardinals won. The Cardinals won by 3 games over the Mets. The Expos were just a game back of the Mets.
Okay.
And the Phillies were 80-82. The Pirates were 80-82, and the Cubs were 76-82.
Yeah, I forgot about the Phillies. I think we chronicled the fact that this is actually the beginning of a really dark period for the Phillies, which we rehashed 89 and 90. They were laughably awful before they reemerged in 93. So, but they were still competitive enough in 87. It was a weird. It was just an interesting. Just a interesting arrangement that the joke is Andre Dawson wins the MVP from a last place team. And that's technically true, but I've always maintained the team from the year before, which we've discussed, which did not finish last, worse by degrees of magnitude. So, there's always a little more context.
The Giants won the West.
Yep. And then Candy Maldonado couldn't make a routine throw on a sacrifice fly in the LCS against the Cardinals. Although Mike Kruko, our guy, did throw a complete game against the Cardinals in that season's NLCS. I was pulling hard. I didn't hate the Cardinals like I do now, but I was pulling for the Giants in that LCS.
Where is Kruks? It's his only postseason appearance.
One game?
Yep.
Wow.
1-0, threw a complete game, gave up 2 runs, struck out 3, walked 1. That's pretty good if that's your only postseason appearance, throw a complete
Fuck
game.
Fuck yeah. Good for Kruks, man. And he was teammates with Rick Rush on that team. That was the Cardinals going back to the World Series after the Don Denkinger kicked in the nuts, and then they would get kicked in the nuts again. So, sometimes there is proof of a god. Granted, they got to win pennants in both of those years, but the Cardinals, those are two pretty traumatic World Series losses, I would say.
Yeah,
coming, they are 2 years apart.
So, how do you think Will Clark, he famously in the 89 NLCS went batshit on the Cubs, hit 650, 682, 1.200 slug, 1882 OPS. He was mashed, almost hit for hit by Mark Grace, but not quite.
You going to tell me he shit the tub in 87 as a rookie?
87? Is he a rookie in 87?
I believe so. I think him and Andres Galarraga, there's a whole bunch of rookie first basemen coming up, like Wally Joyner.
It was the second year. He had finished fifth rookie of the year before.
86 was the year for rookie first baseman.
360, 429, 560, 989 OPS.
Holy shit, really? In the 87?
Yeah, he was pretty good.
His money.
And then he did not, after the, he hit 250 in the World Series against the A's. For Texas, he was in the playoffs twice. He really struggled against the Yankees both times. 2000, was that the year? Did McGuire get hurt? And that's why he had to take over as first baseman in St. Louis. In the NLCS against the Mets, which they lost.
In 2000?
Yeah. The Thrill hit 412. He was 36 years old. 412, 500 on base, 706 slug.
Mm. Why not? Lucky he came in.
Yep.
Yeah, I have this image of a Sporting News cover in my head where there were like a bevy of National League. I thought I mentioned Wally Joyner, but maybe it was just National League first base, and they were all rookies around the same time. And you're right, I think it was 86 because Andres Galarraga was a bust, but he was very hyped for the Expos in 86, and then he reemerged when the Rockies came to town. But Will Clark was in that group. So I think it was both leagues. Wally Joyner was in that group. I don't know.
Leon Durham.
It's not like, Durham was established, just like Don Mattingly was established. But and it's not like it's that noteworthy that they're a bunch of good first basemen. It's not the hardest position to find, but, maybe shoehorn Mark Grace in there. Mark Grace, 1987, he and Dwight Smith going for the Eastern League batting crown. That was going on that year. The future looked bright. The season, they were not a bad team, right? I think we've we've sized it up. I mean, there were some bad teams around them. 81, 86, not too far after that. They were a last place team, sure, but there was no reason to not be a Cubs fan in 87, honest to God. And then the offseason happened.
Yep, and then Jim Frey got his hands on the wheel and started driving it quickly into the ditch. Even though they would, it was proof of how, just how much talent they had in the organization that despite his best efforts, they still won in 1989. Couldn't screw it up completely, only partially.
Enough to get credit for it when, as we've established, the 89 team is really a Dallas Green production. Green had burned too many bridges. Green was, you know, this is the era, you know, he's working in the same town as Mike Ditka. You know, we loved our bombastic assholes. And Green, it was justified with Green. You know, he was the first manager to take the dead-ass Phillies franchise all the way to World Championship. He leveraged that fucking turnaround, this four-decade dead-ass Cubs franchise as an executive. And, you know, he burned some bridges. He didn't make a lot of great moves. Like, you know, he screwed things up sometimes for himself, like not hiring John Vukovic. Like, why would you bring Stick Michael? It'd just be used against you. You know, things like overlooking, you know, administrative things like having to sweat out the Sutcliffe trade because he didn't put his guys, Carter and Hall, through waivers. And he almost lost Fergie Jenkins and then had to trade, you know, the great Scott Fletcher. That one accidentally worked out for him because we got Steve Trout and Warren Brewster. But, you know, a little bit of a mixed bag. He wasn't perfect, but he obviously fucking turned that ship around. He was a pretty dynamic, exceptional person. But by 87, though, I think he'd used up a lot of his bullets with the tight asses at the Tribune Company. And, like, John Madigan, not the John Madigan, who is Field of Dreams star Amy's father, who was in WBBM radio, but the Tribune John Madigan, I think, is the guy that kind of came to loggerheads with Green after the season. But it came down to Tribune Company thinking they knew more shit than, you know, the guys they hired. And they, I think the official record is that Dallas Green stepped down, but he was forced out. And it was weird because the day that he was canned, I remember it was the day that I went for my driver's permit. I was 15 years old. It was October. The season had ended. Listened to the radio, and the guy's driving us to the DMV. And he was forced out. But the story was always that supposedly he was going to finally hire John Vukovic to replace, you know, to fill the void left by, you know, first Gene Michael, then Frank Lucchese. And then supposedly he scrapped those plans and he was going to come down from the front office and manage the team himself. We don't know exactly what it was, but he was definitely forced out. And then, as we've established, they charted a course that just dove them right into the ground after that. So that's it. That's my take.
Because he did. He managed again. He managed the Mets.
Yeah, we talked about that. He was in the other dugout in some game, and the Yankees. No,
oh no, just the Mets. Yeah, the Yankees after he left the Cubs, he managed the Yankees for a year and then the Mets for four.
Which I always felt bad about because, like, not that you should feel bad for a guy that like made millions of dollars and. But it was like a demo, like he reached the pinnacle. He takes the Phillies, he takes the Cubs, you know, these pinnacles. And then he's like, he's got to put on the fucking pinstripe. He's got to fucking take answers from George Steinbrenner. Like he had to work, and he didn't have to work. I'm sure he could have lived off what he made, but he kind of had to go back into the grind. It was always sad. I was at the opening day in 1994, and Tuffy Rhodes hit the three homers after Dwight Gooden. And I remember how cool it was that at the end of batting practice, Dallas, you know, nobody knew who it was right away, but he kind of runs out with his jacket on just to grab a couple balls and throw them into the stands. And like, we gave him his due. You know, we're in the bleachers. Like, even then in 1994, like, Dallas, we're not going to forget you. But it was kind of like bittersweet. It was sad. Like, oh, look at him. Again, proper context. He's making millions of dollars. Yeah. I'm just saying, relative to the pinnacle he was at, it's kind of sad that he had to kind of slough it off and, you know, tell Vince Coleman to stop throwing bleach on reporters. Or, I don't know. Was that Brett Saber? I don't know. But
Vince was throwing kind of a firecrackers at fans.
He didn't really have the best end. You know, he didn't go out on a high note.
Yeah, most people don't.
Well, no, right. So,
all right. Well, that's 87. So, Next up is the long-awaited Pleasure Cruise of 2004.
We've... when we were doing the wheel, there were at least 2 weeks where the wheel almost fell on 2004, yep. And I just don't know how I'd feel. I'm conflicted because I got to get it out, but I'm anxious about it because there's a lot of frustration, a lot of emotions.
Well, and it's timely because there's a lot of comparisons of the 2022 White Sox to the 2000.
Yeah, maybe we can recruit some Sox fan listeners. You know, bump the listener count.
Yeah,
on second thought, yeah. Maybe not such a good idea. So, but yeah, well, it should be interesting. But I think we gave 87 its due.
Yeah, and then some. Even if we talked for the first 10 minutes about the Rangers of the 77 Rangers for no apparent reason.
As soon as we hang up, I'm not even fucking joking. It will be finding reasons why I've never known about the 1977 Texas Rangers. So, got some homework to do.
All right. Well, you do that then.
Thanks, Andy. I will.
Many of us have herpes.
I just want this to be over.